Hey, what's up, everyone? This is Jeremiah Roberts, one of the co-hosts here at Cultish. We're going to bring you into our brand new historical origin series on the origins of William Branham in just a moment. But want to let you know that, as we mentioned previously, we are going through some major transitions slash overhauls at Cultish. We just managed to get the Super Sleuth landed in Utah, so it's going to be very interesting what the future of Cultish looks like. And there's a lot of other things we are currently working behind the scenes to make Cultish bigger and better than ever, as much as you love to get this content on a regular basis. So if you feel led to help partner with us, we would ask that you prayerfully consider helping us continue this ministry. This can only continue with your direct support. So if you want to go to thecultishshow.com, there is a donate tab. You can donate one time, or you can become a monthly partner with us as we move forward in these strange and uncertain times. And also, if you want to get some Cultish merch, you can go to shopcultish.com. You can check out some of our awesome merch, and we'll be having some new designs being added very soon with our brand new overhaul. And also, if you want to help support this studio in which Cultish is centered out of, you can go to apologiastudios.com. You can become an all-access member. Lots of wonderful, fantastic content there as well, too, that helps support the studio that also makes Cultish a possibility. Okay, so our guest today, this is a long-awaited series. So much of you have been asking for this. It is finally here. We are going to begin talking about William Branham and his organization, The Message, and its origins. Really fascinating discussion. We are strictly focusing on, in this particular episode, the first part of our series, William Branham's upbringing, his childhood. What was the sociological infrastructure in the 1920s? What was it like? How did that make him into who he was? So I hope you all enjoy this fascinating discussion with John Collins. Enjoy the first part of this fascinating podcast with John Collins talking about William Branham.
My name is Eddie, and I was in a call.
Planet Earth about to be recycled. Your only chance to survive or evacuate is to leave with us.
Started as an effort by a charismatic preacher to build a new society, but it ended, of course, with the tragic deaths of more than 900 people.
Please, for God's sake, let's get on with it. We've lived as no other people have lived and loved. We've had as much of this world as you're going to get. Let's just be done with it. Let's be done with the agony of it. This is a revolutionary suicide. This is not a self-destructive suicide. So they'll pay for this. They brought this upon us.
You're in a cult. I love you, and I want you out of it and with Christ.
But you're...
May I present my wife? Honey, this is Brother Leroy and Paul Kopp of Los Angeles, California.
Delighted to have you in our home, Brother Kopp.
Brother Branham, in your two great campaigns at Los Angeles, at Calvary Temple, we noticed that the Lord Jesus Christ worked with you in a very special manner. With these marvelous gifts, discerning of the spirits of men's hearts, as well as the sicknesses of their body and the signs of healing and miracles that were wrought, we thought it was wonderful.
We're interested, Brother Branham, in hearing more about this unique ministry that God has given you.
Very well, Brother Kopp. Let's go back to the beginning. I was born in eastern Kentucky in a little log cabin near Burkesville, Kentucky. The morning of my birth, I'm told of my parents that there was a light came into the room and hung over me. My people was not a religious people. They did not go to any church. Of course, this caused quite a stir among them. It's followed me all the days of my life. Recently, they took a picture of it in the scientific world, as shown here. You're probably familiar with this picture. It was proven by science that it was the only supernatural being that was ever scientifically photographed. To my opinion, it's the same angel of God that followed the children of Israel.
All right, welcome back. ladies and gentlemen, to Cultish Entering the Kingdom of the Cults. My name is Jeremiah Roberts. I'm one of the co-hosts here. I am here, as always, with Andrew, the super sleuth of the show. Tell me, are you super excited about today?
I am very excited about today because, like, you know, the weird pair-up with, like, cowboys and aliens, this is kind of like the weird pair-up with gangsters, alcohol, and
prohibition
and preachers in a weird sense. And I'm excited. And I'm very excited for the guest that we have with us, this awesome historian. Introduce
yes,
him.
Absolutely. And so we have gotten quite a few messages really since our inception about Cultish. And we every single time we've made a post about this, just the response have been astronomical regarding William Branham, the Branhamites, or also known as The Message. And so we were doing our own research. We came across our guest, and just the amount of research that he has done has just been absolutely fascinating. And we are excited to unravel with you all. Really, what this is going to be kind of a historical origins story or origin series, or sometimes you'll see another podcast. I think there's a podcast called The Strange History Podcast. Or Weird History. There's a lot of those ones out there. So we're kind of in uncharted waters as far as exploring into new territory. But we have with us John Collins. How are you, my friend?
I'm good. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. And so can you just tell everyone just a little bit about yourself? And you've done a lot of history about William Branham. Just tell them a little bit about yourself. And then if people are curious to find out more, where can they find you at on the World Wide Web?
I'm on william-branham.org and also on Amazon. You can find the latest book is Preacher Behind the White Hoods, The Critical Examination of William Branham. Also, I'm on the Alternative Considerations of Jonestown and People's Temple. I write in their newsletter, so you can find various research about many, many subjects regarding this strange history.
Yes, and I'm sure a couple. Go ahead.
Sorry, my family was born and raised in the Branham cult. My grandfather was the pastor at William Branham's Branham Tabernacle in Jeffersonville for almost 50 years until I started publishing some of the more critical and the more revealing information. He was actually pushed out of that church.
Yeah, that's definitely very, yeah. Well, I appreciate you sharing that, and we're excited to delve into the origins of William Branham. And so if you heard that audio, that's I came across that on YouTube, and it's an old vintage video of some people in William Branham's home in Jeffersonville, Indiana. And so what we want to do is that we want to go really as much minute detail as we can, go into the origins of William Branham's story. As you heard in that audio, John, I noticed that he mentioned it started in Kentucky and it worked its way over to Jeffersonville, Indiana. And so he had a very interesting upbringing around some very interesting changing times in American history. You know, we think right now how interesting the 2020s have been so far. This was roughly 100 years ago around his upbringing. So take us at the very beginning of the origins of William Branham, where he was born in Kentucky, and about his family and maybe some of the sociological infrastructure that really made him into the person he was as a young man.
Well, honestly, it depends on which version of his stage persona that you subscribe to. The one that seems to be lasting the longest through time was the version in which he was born in 1909 in Burkesville, Kentucky, in a log cabin. And according to cult history, a light shone in on in the window, and he had a what they call a supernatural birth. Previous versions of his stage persona didn't have that part of the story, and his actual birth year ranges from 1907, which appears to be his actual birth date. He signed, I believe, 1908 in one government document, and then later versions of his stage persona are all using the year 1909. And the cult that I grew up in, the version of the stage persona that we subscribe to, we tied several supernatural events to that year of 1909, even though that appears not to be his actual birth date, birth year. His family, according to what his statements that he made, his family were from Paris, Texas, right above Paris, Texas in Oklahoma. And they migrated to Kentucky near the Cumberland River and lived there for approximately 3 years. And for one reason or another, they moved to Jeffersonville, Indiana. At the time, Jeffersonville was a quickly growing town. It had quite a bit of opportunity, but it was also the location of the state prison. So I have questions as to why they moved, but he, for one reason or another, that's where they ended up. And, like you say, this was at a strange and unusual time in American history, especially with all of the combination of different influences that came to be in Jeffersonville, Indiana.
Mm. So could you give us some examples of just what were things going on? We mentioned at the very beginning the Prohibition era. This was very much a lot of racial tensions were going on. This was, you know, way before the civil rights movement, and that had a variable in play. But specifically, what would be some things that William Branham as a young boy and ultimately a young man would have observed of the world around him that would have affected just who he ended up becoming?
Yeah, so in Jeffersonville, it was right across the river from Louisville, Kentucky. So it was a gambling town. It was known as Little Las Vegas. During the Prohibition era, people like, you know, Al Capone or John Dillinger frequented the area. I believe one of their, I don't know if it's their largest supplier, but one of their suppliers of alcohol had his distilleries in the area. And his father grew up, or his father worked for the for Mr. Wathen, who owned the Wathen distilleries. So you had the influence of the alcoholism, and you had the influence that, you know, in a casino town during Prohibition, whenever a lot of government officials in Jeffersonville were purposefully turning a blind eye. You had all of the crime and the riffraff that came with that in this gambling town. But you also had the influence of the Ku Klux Klan, who were quickly growing. After 1915, I believe it was, they were quickly growing in state of Indiana, and they eventually would become the largest Klan sect in the United States.
Hmm.
That's huge. That's huge. And so one thing that you had just pointed out is that William Branham with his family moved from Kentucky when he was about three. One thing I found very interesting in your book as well is that the message and what William Branham likes to state is something different, right? They believe something totally different about how old he was and mm-hmm. things of that nature. What is their story, and what were some of the underpinnings? Like, what were you able to find that actually showed the different history to make you go, well, actually, factually, they entered the town at a totally different age, right? Could you talk about that for just a minute?
Right. Yeah. Well, even the visual landscape that we were given as part of the, I call it the cult history because it's not actual history.
Right.
They make these coloring books that they give to the kids where it's showing Jeffersonville as this one horse town like you would see in Bonanza. And, you know, he would go to the general store and he would get his piece of candy at the general store. When I actually saw the photos from various history sources in the area, one of which being the Jeffersonville Library, we also have the Jeffersonville Historical Society, I was just shocked that this is not the town that I knew as cult history. And The timeline was, I think, most shocking because he claimed that in some versions of his stage persona, he claimed that he received a vision as a small child before most children could even walk or talk, and told his family that he would be moving to a city, you know, near New Albany, which is adjacent, I guess, two cities over from Jeffersonville. And, you know, according to the timeline that he gives in that version of his life story, compared to the government documents that I was able to uncover and the, you know, the newspaper articles where his family's mentioning the timeline, none of it matched.
Right.
So that's what caused me, I think, to dig deeper into, you know, just the basics. What is the actual history? What is the history that was concealed for me, and why was it concealed?
Mm. Yeah, and I think one of the things that's really fascinating when you talk about, again, how something that's a very well-known time in history and how this really affects someone, it affected William Branham on a personal level. So in your book, you had mentioned about, you know, the difference how between Indiana and Kentucky. And in your book, you stated that Indiana and Kentucky says they are both impacted by anti-saloon legislation because when you think about the 1800s, mm-hmm. and kind of any of those old Westerns, you have somebody, you know, walking into the saloon and they're playing that classic piano saloon mm-hmm. music. And then there's the showdown that was just indicative of just Western history and a lot of times depicted in Clint Eastwood movies and things like that. But what happened mm-hmm. is that once this prohibition legislation came in, there was this anti-saloon legislation. So it said that between mm-hmm. 1905, and you think about too, like all the small businesses that have been shut down and destroyed by the different government regulations with COVID. I mean, that has really changed the nature of commerce and business and such. But you mentioned that in that time frame, more than 2,500 Indiana saloons were closed between 1900 and 1910. And that affected mm-hmm. William Branham's childhood because his father became involved in Prohibition. And it says that one of the most impactful things that happened is that Charles Branham, his father, pulled him out of school. And so that kind of really changed mm-hmm. a lot as far as his upbringing. Can you kind of just elaborate on that?
Yeah, so it's... you know, it was very surprising to me to see just how dominant the gambling and the liquor industry was in this area. There's a grocery store near my house that I used. It's actually closed and replaced now with another building. But when we first moved here, there's a grocery store called, I think it was the Greyhound Grocery. And it used to be the dog track. And this dog track, they raced Greyhound dogs, and people would, you know, bet on the dogs, and there was liquor, gambling, etc. And they had monkeys that would ride on the backs of these dogs.
That's wild.
And somewhere I found a photograph of these monkeys that were being jockeys on the dogs.
Wow.
It's amazing the history as it relates to the organized crime. We had the distilleries here, right? I never really thought about it when I was in the cult because most of this history I did not know.
Right.
Even general American history. I really, to be honest, I was not interested in history growing up because we're going to be leaving this world and it's going to be demolished. Why do I care?
Right.
But this has just sparked a new fascination for history that I almost can't control. Mm. So you have people like John Dillinger and people like Al Capone coming to do business in Louisville, Kentucky. And there's a hotel, I think it's called the Sealback Hotel, where they have the Al Capone room, and you can go down in it and see all the tunnels where he escaped whenever the law came in. During this time, the government was cracking down on alcohol production.
Yeah.
And a lot of the distilleries could not produce and sell to the casinos. Wathen, R.E. Wathen is a name that I heard, or Otto Wathen, his son, was a name that I heard growing up, because William Branham frequently mentioned that he lived near the Wathan house. Said his dad was, he said a chauffeur, but now that I'm understanding what this was, he was a driver for Wathan. And Wathan was able to continue producing liquor under a medicinal license, but his trucks kept getting caught taking liquor to Chicago. And so what he did was quite ingenious. He had several people either funded them or they bought the materials themselves and started producing White Mule whiskey in their backyards. So it was out of his distillery, but then this was supplying the Chicago mob.
Wow.
And when you piece that fact together with the history that William Branham gives, now I understand that William Branham, as a child, was taken out of school to run his father's still to produce liquor directly for Al Capone. Wow. And the Chicago mob.
Yeah, so I got a question too, because when you think about Al Capone, that name, just what it, like, you think to our audience listening, like, what does that bring up? And for me, it's almost like that name, it's almost sort of like the Michael Jordan of just gangsters in the 1920s. I mean, he was just, that's just right. The impact that he had. I mean, he's been depicted several times in films. He was depicted, I believe, by Robert De Niro in the movie, I can't remember the name off the top of my head, with Kevin Costner and Sean Connery.
Untouchables.
Yes. Yes. And also he was depicted in the HBO series Boardwalk Empire, which I jokingly said this whole story could literally be a spinoff of that show, just given the context of what took place there. So Al Capone was known, really, he was someone who was also known for the distribution of liquor, and that's depicted in the films, and you see that too in Boardwalk Empire. But I did have a question I want to bring up, because you mentioned Johnny Dillinger. And so for anyone who knows, and this is what I know, I want to get your thoughts on this, John, is that he was depicted in the movie Public Enemies by Johnny Depp that I think came out in 2009. And he was really known for just being so proficient at robbing banks. He just said he was just good at it, and people didn't have an answer how to stop it. And that played a huge role in the formulation of the FBI that was started by, I think the first director was Purvis Ellison, who was played by Christian Bale, which is one of my really well-done film. It's one of the first films that was done in the high-speed 4K cameras. So I remember watching the theater, it was at the higher speed rate. Sorry, this is my movie nerd part of me that's coming out.
I love it.
So I
just saw it for the first time last month. So
nice.
I'm new to this movie. Yeah.
Okay, so you mentioned Johnny Dillinger. So just in relation to Kentucky, was he in? How was he, aside from being involved in Kentucky, as far as how this whole story unravels, what sort of influence did Johnny Dillinger had with what he did with his bank robbing?
My areas of research so far have been limited to anything that I can tie directly to Branham or the people Branham knew. Outside of the fact that John Dillinger came to Louisville and was doing business here, I really haven't studied it that much.
Okay.
I want to now that I've seen the movie, but I've not studied it yet.
Right. But I mean, it means to say it's still incredibly fascinating that a person like Johnny Dillinger, who was depicted by Johnny Depp in a movie directed by Michael Mann, who's done a lot of other fantastic films as well too, just goes to show you what a interesting and fascinating, unique time in history this was. And the fact that this religious figure and really this movement came out, this is the sociological environment that created really what, you know, was your life. Mm-hmm. And now you, this has become really a passion subject for you as far as really digging out this history. So definitely fascinating.
Absolutely.
For sure.
Absolutely. So as a child, you know, the version of the stage persona that I grew up with, this was a hunter, a fisher, a trapper who lived in the wilderness. Previous versions of his stage persona, he actually claimed that he grew up in Kentucky. He claimed that his father died at an early age, so he would hunt and trap to feed his siblings in this log cabin. I never really thought about it until after I left, that even the ages of his sibling doesn't work with that stage persona. It can't work. They're too old. And so I've got this mental image of this guy who I thought was the prophet.
Yeah.
Who's, you know, running through the hills of Kentucky. And somehow in my mind, I had merged the two because I had heard both stage personas.
Right.
So in my mind, I'm thinking he ran through the hills of Kentucky hunting, trapping, fishing, and he also ran through the hills of Jeffersonville, Indiana, hunting, trapping, and fishing. Mm. And then I saw the pictures. Oh my gosh, man, you had Jeffersonville was the main hub of distribution for the Civil War. Taking, you know, the railroad across the Ohio River is where all the supplies went from north to south. So you had the depot, you had the train station, they had all the infrastructure. By the time the Branhams moved here, they actually had, you know, trolleys and railways, and there was a like a shuttle train that would take you around to four different cities, and the depot was right there in Jeffersonville. So you've got this boy who's not hunting and trapping and fishing in the wilderness,
right,
who's in this gambling town with the casinos, with the mobsters, whose father likely met with them. There's no way to prove that, but he was a driver for the big man. So there's no telling how much he knew and how, and what he saw.
Right. Like his father was even bailed out by Otto, right? Like from prison, wasn't he?
That shocked me because I'm like you, I'm picturing in my mind, I'm thinking Robert De Niro and I'm picturing, you know, Al Capone, if one of his guys that he had make liquor got caught, there's no way in heck he's going to go bail him out. So now you come to Jeffersonville, you've got the big man and you've got, you know, Charles Branham, who's his driver, and he's bailing out his driver for producing liquor when all of the other people that were producing liquor for Al Capone, I did not find a single newspaper article, record, government document, anything of anyone else being bailed out, just Charles Branham.
Mm. Wow, that's fascinating. And you know what's really interesting, John, too, is when you think about, like, what does this remind me of? And Andrew, I think about, you know, we've done several episodes before, and when we've had on Mormonism, and, you know, I went to a school that my high school, I went to, it was 98% Mormon, and a lot of my close friends were Mormon. And, you know, I would spend time going to their house and I would see some of their history books. They're these really nice cookie cutter stories about the Mormon pioneers and how they just wanted to live peacefully, how Joseph Smith of 14 years old went out into the woods to pray, and just this very nice, very methodical, very, you know, very almost what you call it, those precious moments books.
Yeah.
Or it's just very,
right.
That's the way it's just depicted. Yeah.
A Hallmark moment.
Yeah. It's a very Hallmark movie sort of moment, but there's almost a similarity to how, you know, William Branham's father, Charles, is involved, you know, as a driver, or just as involved in the Prohibition movement connected, that's directly connected to Al Capone and a lot of these other organizations that are in this area. But there's a similarity too. I mean, Joseph Smith's whole family, like, they were involved in the aspects of treasure digging and glass looking, and saying they had special secret occultic esoteric insight to be able to find lost and hidden treasures. In fact, Joseph Smith was actually tried and convicted, and there's an arrest record for him doing this, which, and this is a thing too. Mm-hmm. I know people, when they grow up with this perception of Joseph Smith, when they find out this stuff, there's a lot of cognitive dissonance that's happened. I'm sure that would be the case for a lot of people who look into this. Go ahead.
Absolutely. So you played that clip from the one single video of William Branham's home that exists. He had a video camera, by the way. He mentions getting it for Christmas. Mm. So somewhere exists more videos of him, but that's the only one we're allowed to see. But what's funny is, you mentioned the cognitive dissonance. I had no choice. I was born and raised in this thing. I was raised from birth to believe that every single part of this version of the stage persona was true. And I really had no chance to even question it. And by the time I was about 16 or so, I started listening to his recordings over and over in my car at night, in school between classes, at lunch in school, on the bus on the way home. So I'm literally brainwashing myself, right?
Yeah.
With this stuff. And I saw that video that you referenced at the beginning of the show, And I can remember sitting down and as an 18-year-old boy crying because that's the prophet. Mm. And how real this is, man. How this is, why can the world not accept this? I mean, that's a true thought that was in my head. Mm-hmm. I recently got done watching the series called WandaVision on Disney Plus.
Yeah.
I don't know if you guys have seen this. Yeah, so it's this world that's just like that video, man. It's as fake can possibly be. Mm-hmm. And it dawned on me while watching that, because you can see in the very beginning, they don't know it's fake. And then towards the middle of it, of the first season, you can kind of start to see something's just not right. And Vision starts to notice that Wanda's got this fake smile and she's saying that things that aren't real. The moment I saw that, I thought of this video that you played, because all of the faces look plastic. The voices don't seem real.
Wow.
None of it seems real. But when I was growing up, that was very, very real to me.
Mm.
Wow.
Oh, wow. So I was going to ask something too. And Andrew, do you have any other questions before we transition? What are your thoughts around? I feel like your mind's being blown.
Yeah,
right,
it just
now.
Blew my mind. That was a very poetic way to put that, John. And I was just thinking, like, you're essentially right. There's a script that he had, you know, there's a script, a stage persona, there's the cult history that they went by, and you had to go through that. And then you got a glimpse behind the veil, and it's everything changed after that. You just, yeah, it just hit me really hard when you were talking about that, John.
Yeah, definitely. And so on top of the Al Capone and some of the prohibition movements, what I noticed in your book, you start talking about the influence that the Ku Klux Klan had on in Jeffersonville, and also just some of their influence. And people, especially now, you think about this in today's day and age, like the word white supremacy gets thrown around almost like a pejorative, but it had a very different meaning and context in the 1920s versus how it's depicted now, nearly 100 years later. But the Ku Klux Klan, I mean, that's something that's very, when you think about that, that's something people see in the white hoods and the burning crosses out in the woods and such. But in your book, you talk about the relationship that the Ku Klux Klan had with the Branham family. Specifically, there's a point where it said Charles was arrested, and then he had a bail posted. And there were some relations between the Ku Klux Klan and Charles Branham. Can you talk just a little bit about that and what sort of effect that would have had on William?
That's a very interesting history that could probably take the next 5 podcasts to fully cover.
Yeah.
I will try to limit it to just the brief overview.
Sure.
And anybody who's interested in seeing further can, read my book or go to my website. But there were the white supremacy in this area came from multiple angles. Interestingly, growing up in the cult, I would frown upon people who claimed to be white supremacists. I did not like the Klan. I thought I was a person who supported equal rights. It wasn't until after I left that I realized just how racist I actually was. Mm-hmm. I had no idea. Right down to the doctrine that William Branham taught, there is so much racism flowing through it, which I'll get into a bit further probably in the show. But the influence in Jeffersonville specifically. So the 1915 Ku Klux Klan, I don't know how much you guys know about the Klan, but in 1915, it was rebirthed from a previous version of the Klan. There was an event that happened in Atlanta, Georgia. Series of events that happened in Atlanta, Georgia. There was a lynching of a Jewish man who they claimed raped a white woman. The Klan was not just against blacks, as is commonly mistaken. They were white supremacists, so you mm-hmm. basically had to be white, but not just white. They were against the Catholics. They're heavily anti-Catholicism. They discriminated against Jews, African Americans. Basically, if you did not have white skin and you did not have the culture of the people who were enforcing it, they looked down upon you. So in 1915, the Klan was rebirthed, and it was extremely popular. It spread throughout the United States. People did not really know what this was, but they saw it as like unsung heroes. There was a movie that came out, drawn a blank, Birth of a Nation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that movie was played across the United States, right? And it made the previous version of the Klan look like heroes. So in 1915 on Stone Mountain, Georgia, a group of men recreated the Klan, created as a pyramid scheme, and it was a religious pyramid scheme. Mm-hmm. Spread throughout the United States, and around 1921, I believe it was, the government started realizing that these forces are actually controlling small governments. Mm. So it divided into separate sects, and the Indiana sect grew to be the strongest. So their influence in Indiana, from Indianapolis, was just dominating, you know, in the United States. There was a Klan headquarters on Spring Street in downtown Jeffersonville. I believe it was right across the casino or maybe adjacent to the biggest casino. Mm-hmm. And the Klan wanted to clean up the mob. So you had Charles Branham, the father, who's working for supplying the Chicago mob. Mm-hmm. You had the Klan who's coming in trying to stop it. And the Indianapolis Klan newspaper started publishing all of the various cities that they went in and cleaned house. And they started waging war against Jeffersonville specifically. Jeffersonville had several people who were Catholics who were in positions of power or positions of influence. You had the mob, the casinos. You also had quick marriages. People would come from Louisville to the casinos. There were a series of small, not really churches, but they called them churches, where people could go get married, go sleep with one another, go get divorced, and go back home. And this was a huge problem in this era. So the Ku Klux Klan came in and cleaned house. And they bragged about it in their newspaper in Indianapolis. During the time that they came in and cleaned house in Jeffersonville, William Branham, whose father is out making whiskey, his father gets stopped, put into jail, and William Branham gets shot.
Right.
There's no way of knowing other than his statement who shot him, but you can see that this happened during the exact time that the Klan came in and cleaned house.
Hmm. And he was in critical condition, too. Like, this is like a serious wound when he was shot, right?
It was a serious, according to the newspapers, it was a serious state of affairs on all sides. You had two Branham boys who were in critical condition. I'm trying to remember which, in the series of time, which they were, but you had one of the Branham brothers had shot another person. Another one had been in a severe injury, fell off of a truck, I believe it was. William Branham had been shot. The father was in jail. The family was destitute. And the Klan, according to William Branham, the Ku Klux Klan came in and saved the day, not only for rescuing him from producing liquor, apparently,
right,
but also paid his hospital bills. And shortly after, he had a series of new cars. So things went very well after that happened.
Yeah, that's definitely very interesting. In fact, one of the things that is just fascinating about this period of history, and this also has to do with the world of cults that we study, is just the effect of persuasion and undue influence when it comes to propaganda and how people can be indoctrinated. So early, just jumping back a little bit, the film Birth of a Nation, while I have not seen it in entirety, I have no intentions to. I've seen just little bits and clips, and believe me, as someone who is a Christian, where I believe that all men are equal before the eyes of God, we are all image bearers of God. The way that people are depicted in that is just horrific when I see that. But what's unique about that film, though, it really has become a really it's almost a case study in and of itself for the effectiveness of propaganda, because this was made in, I believe, in 1915, and just the the effect that it had was just astronomical. And I mean, it changed really the landscape, even post-Civil War, that which the Civil War fought over, that really influenced this hatred towards so many other people. That was unprecedented, going working all the way to William Branham and affecting him.
So now we had the Ku Klux Klan coming to the rescue, paying hospital bills and making an impact on William Branham's life. And you said that now William Branham had vehicles. So what can you tell me what the cult history was of William Branham's life at this point in comparison to the actual historical records of him going, like, moving away from Jeffersonville? Could you highlight that for a minute?
That is the most interesting thing, and that is what drove me mad for several years, man. there was a missing piece of his history. Mm-hmm. At that time, when I first started looking at that, I didn't yet recognize that there were different versions of the stage persona. We had, I believe it was 1,500, 1,400 sermons recorded by William Branham from 1947 to 1965.
Wow.
I, as a child, probably by age 16 or 17, had heard every one of those multiple times and could probably quote at least 15 or 20 of them almost verbatim as he was talking. I'd heard them so many times. What happens is that whenever you have two conflicting histories, cognitive dissonance, especially in a cult, your brain will try to reconcile both. So what happens is you have one story which can't be reconciled with the other story. So your mind creates a new story that uses elements of both, but in effect, it's a story that is neither, because it's a mixture of the two that didn't really happen.
Right.
So in my mind, part of my mind remembered the version of his stage persona where his father died at a very early age. And William Branham told these stories that I remember growing up and just laughing and laughing, how he and all his brothers were in this log cabin in Kentucky because his father had died. He was hunting and trapping to feed them. And his mother would pour coon grease in their eyes to open them in the morning. And I that's a story that I always wondered about, the coon grease. I remember vividly, you know, that story. But I also believe that he was in Jeffersonville. I can't explain that, but my mind had reconciled the two.
Right.
And I believe that this happened, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, when this happens and your mind creates this new story that doesn't exist, what happens is you overlook all the details that should be there and aren't. So the Branham family history goes up to a certain point where the two stage personas diverge, and then there's this missing history that is unaccounted for. There is, I believe there was one, either one or two of the different versions of stage personas where he talks about going out west and he wants to be a rodeo rider. And that's the only thing that really you get that that even gives you a hint of what happened. But according to what little information I was able to gather, it appears that he got a brand new vehicle, back at a time whenever he was so claimed to be so poor he couldn't scrape two pennies together.
Right.
He headed out west. It looks like he went to Phoenix, Arizona. There are a couple of quotes where he mentions being on a specific street in Phoenix. And then I found this series of old photographs from that era, and it looks an awful lot like he went to college, which would completely defy all of the stage personas that I'm familiar with.
Mm-hmm. Do you know what activities... Sorry, John, did you know what activities he would have participated while he was in Arizona? I'm curious as well, just because we are We're both from Arizona. At least we're in Arizona now. Andrew will be going up to Utah in a couple months. But yeah, what do you know his activity or what his proposed activity was when he was here in our great state?
I don't. The only thing close, he talks about breaking horses, but the street that he mentions, I was able to find old archives from the Phoenix Historical Society of the street where he's mentioning. And it blew my mind because as I'm trying to piece all of this together and I'm picturing this barren wilderness and he's out bucking broncos, he's near a skyscraper. I mean, he could have probably looked out his back window and saw a skyscraper being built.
Right.
That's how right in the heart of it he was. I really haven't been able to tell, and a lot of the records that I want to find would no longer exist from that era.
Yeah.
But, you know, I can tell you that there is a strong cult presence in Arizona. Tucson, Arizona is the second part of the dual headquarters that he had. So you may be able to find some people there who know more than I do.
Oh, that's an interesting idea. Yeah. So, I always found that really interesting when I was watching your videos that you did on your website. So Jerry, where he was living was nowadays 16th Street in Buckeye. So you don't go around there at nighttime anymore.
No, you
by
don't.
By yourself. Uh-huh. But yeah, that is close to downtown Phoenix. And I thought you did a really good job in the videos I watched online in terms of deducing that he was most likely in school, because the photos, there's about four different photos and you can see him aging one by one. They look professionally done. He looks like he's in a school uniform. And actually the photo cover on the front of your book, Preacher Behind the White Hoods, that's one of those photos.
One of those photos.
While he was in Arizona.
Yeah, there's a reason why I chose that too, because even when I found those photos and even as I'm piecing all of this together, I fully discounted the notion that he went to college. It wasn't until I actually had to go back and rewrite parts of my book, because the stage persona that we had accepted was this hillbilly from Kentucky who was raised to only have a sixth or seventh grade education. And he speaks, now that I'm looking at it and understand it, he speaks with a fake Kentucky accent. But after I found those photos and started piecing all this together, and after I found a earlier version of his stage persona where he speaks very, very good English, then it suddenly hit me, wait a minute, could he have gone to college? And that's whenever I went back, and yes, these photographs are 1 year after apart. I mean, they're they look like yearbook photographs from college.
I agree.
So that's why I chose for my book.
That's awesome. Hmm.
Yeah. So I guess what I'm curious about too, because we're kind of getting to the point where, you know, William Branham has had this influence growing up, and he comes across some very other interesting characters, which we'll probably explore in the next episode. But in his upbringing, he's evolved with the Ku Klux Klan, Prohibition, and he eventually starts this religious movement, and he ends up meeting up with someone where that takes place. But prior to him meeting this particular person that we'll introduce, that we also will explore in the next episode, and that became the catalyst for William Branham and the message, what sort of influences were on him, or what might have motivated him in regards to the aspects of preaching, healing, doing the faith healing, the ministry, all those things that really became a catalyst for who he was as the prophet? What sort of things in his upbringing, besides the aspects of the Prohibition, the Ku Klux Klan, might have had undue influence or pushed him in that direction?
During the years that did not exist in the stage persona, I could not find anything even remotely related to religion. And even in the stage personas themselves, he mentioned that his family did not have a religious background and that he avoided religion until his later years. There were some influences indirect that may or may not have came into play. There was a preacher by the name of John Alexander Dowie, who in the late 1890s became known as the richest man in the West. So his fame was, you know, spread throughout the entire nation. I believe that may have influenced some of the other men that you're referring to. So it's possible that, you know, that made some connection or talk just through the fact that Dowie had control of Chicago at one time. But also, there was an event in Jeffersonville that a character named Roy E. Davis, where one of the men that you'll probably want to examine in your next episode, he came he came and basically wowed Jeffersonville with the other big influence that was happening at the time. During this time in the United States, there was this big fascination with spiritualism. I don't know how much you guys have studied this, but Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, who wrote the Sherlock Holmes series, he actually came to the United States so that his wife could perform seances.
Wow.
There was more money in that than writing Sherlock Holmes, believe it or not.
Wow.
And all through the nation, this was just spreading quickly. Indiana, there was a spiritualist camp that was a strong driving force for the spreading of spiritualism in the United States. And one of the statements that William Branham makes leads me to believe that he was actually at that spiritualist camp.
Mm.
So you had the Klan, you had the spiritualism, you had the alcohol / prohibition. Well, a preacher shows up in Jeffersonville claiming that he used to be a spiritualist and that he had figured out all of the demonic tricks that they were practicing. And so he converted to Christianity and basically started this small revival in Jeffersonville that William Branham appears to have taken part in. And that's the first instance in which I see anything remotely religious with William Branham.
And yeah, this was the guy too. And wasn't that, and I remember reading this in the book, he had done this other gentleman. He had, it was really like a stage persona that he was sort of a sage or a medium. So he kind of had, it wasn't just a regular church service in the 1800s, but it would be something that you would see as far as like showmanship of, hey, look
exactly.
What I can have these particular things, which is just interesting given who William Branham became and doing things in very extraordinary claims about miracles and healings, you know, live on stage, which we'll probably get into as we unravel this. One other thing I want to just bring up too, but because we'll wrap up here in a moment and then we're going to jump into the next episode. We'll be talking about a person by the name of Roy Davis. And that's a fascinating story in and of itself. And then we're going to talk about his connection to Branham. But that was a person we were mentioning earlier. But this is a fascinating instance of, it's almost the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. So you're talking about there really is not too much records of any religious interest in William Branham's upbringing. But what we do have tons of records of is a lot of crime, a lot of very close proximity to both Al Capone and Johnny Dillinger, which still fascinates me. It's almost like this could be the spinoff of Boardwalk Empire directed by Martin Scorsese. That's really the nature of this. So this is also just interesting. What I noticed, and maybe you can kind of elaborate, maybe talk a little bit more about, is that there's a point too where William Branham had a large family. It was 10 children, right?
Right.
So 10, very large family. One of his brothers was named, it was Edward Branham. And according to some of your research in your book, you mentioned that that Edward, brother, had shot and killed a man, and that Edward was trading a firearm for an automobile, and he killed a man by the name John Burse. And the witnesses say that the gun was in Branham's hand when he fired at the home of his father, Charles Branham. So, and then he ended up being charged for first degree murder. So that's another aspect where it's just, this is right directly in the family where this murder happens. What were you going to ask, Andrew?
And then Edward Branham dies a few months later. It's listed as rheumatic heart disease. But I just find that interesting.
Yeah, anyways. tell us more, a little more about that. That just sounds very, very much in the realms of previously on Boardwalk Empire.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's just so vastly different from the stage persona that I grew up with. I'm picturing the way it was described for me. It was like picturing several kids in this log cabin, again, in Kentucky, not in Indiana. And even the version of the stage persona where they're in Indiana, I'm picturing kids. I'm picturing, you know, boys who are out playing with sticks, shooting, you know, pretending to be cowboys and Indians or whatever. I did not picture a crime family where one brother is shooting another brother, another guy to get his automobile during a time whenever an automobile was a good way to make money, especially when your father's got a bunch of liquor in his still and supplying the Chicago mob. So there's just so many aspects of this that whenever I began my research, I was researching William Branham from a historical / religious aspect, because I truly thought that he was a religious man. I truly thought that he had some experience, whether it was a true experience or a false one, I don't know. But I thought he had some religious experience that made him want to become a religious person. But I'll be honest, after the research that you've mentioned and some of the research that we'll be discussing in the next episode, I actually took a different pathway in my research and started studying all of the men who went into hiding after Prohibition was lifted. I don't know if you have studied this, but during the time that it was illegal to get the alcohol, these guys were like heroes. They would walk out and they're like movie stars, right? They're walking out in their fancy suits and they're, you know, dodging the government somehow, and they're getting the people liquor. Well, once people could get it for themselves, these were no longer heroes. These were just common criminals. And they all had to go in hiding. I found this one mountain, I can't remember what state that was in, but the entire mountain, there was a hotel built in the face of the mountain, and it was the hideout for all of the big names that just literally couldn't hide. The hotel was a front, and then there was a false door that went way deep into the mountain, and there was a second living space back there. So you had all of these mobsters who went into hiding in, you know, caves and whatnot, but you also had people that went into hiding in public view. And so the thought occurred to me, did William Branham, was he part of this? Did he go in hiding in public view, or did he have a real conversion? And that question led me to researching what we'll be covering in the next episode, what he claims is his conversion in some of his stage personas.
Yes. Excellent. Well, I'm excited to get into that and also get into Roy Davis. So, John, I appreciate you coming on today, and we'll go and wrap things up on that note. So I'm sure this is, if you've enjoyed the first part of our historical origin story version of Cultish, it's Uncharted Waters for us, but we're having a blast so far. So if you're enjoying this episode or you have thoughts on this first section on William Branham with John Collins. Again, John, just real quick, you tell them again, where can they find you again if they want to look further into these materials you're discussing?
You can find me on william-branham.org, also on Amazon in the book Preacher Behind the White Hoods, A Critical Examination of William Branham and His Message. And last, on Alternative Considerations of Jonestown and People's Temple, you'll find several articles in the newsletters.
Okay, excellent. Well, thank you all for listening, and we will talk to you all next time on Cultish. And as always, if you feel led to partner with us and donate, be part of this ministry, you can always go to thecultishshow.com, where you can donate one time or monthly. And if you do that, we definitely appreciate that. So all that being said, we'll talk to you guys next time on Cultish, where we enter into the Kingdom of the Cults. Talk to you guys soon.